gonna stop.
Okay. Welcome everyone, and thank you for coming. I'm Abena Owusu-Bempa. I'm an academic in the law department, and one of the hosts and moderators of this evening's event, alongside my colleague Sonia Onwu. And I'll introduce our panel in just a moment. It's great to see so many people here. It's also obviously not surprising, given that we've got an incredible panel and really interesting topic of conversation. This evening, our panel is going to be talking about countering colorblindness. I'm not going to say much about this by way of introduction, because they will be elaborating and engaging with this in depth. But as a very basic proposition, colorblindness would suggest that it's best to ignore race. So, for example, we could achieve racial equality by simply not acknowledging race. You can't discriminate against someone if you're not taking their race into account. This idea or notion of colorblindness has been adopted and put into practice, or attempted to be put into practice, across various issues and sectors, not least within the academy. But it's an ideology that needs to be challenged. And so this evening, our panel will be challenging and inviting us to challenge this ideology of colorblindness and its underlying logic and assumptions. And these are assumptions which have come to dominate many, many disciplines. They will, I believe, be contending that in order to achieve racial equality, we need to be race conscious rather than colorblind. Colorblindness is also the topic of their recently published edited collection, which is titled Seeing Race Again, Countering Colorblindness Across Disciplines. There isn't a picture of it up, but it's published by the University of California Press earlier this year, and the book itself is the product of a long-term transdisciplinary project also titled Countering Colorblindness, which brought together a number of scholars across different disciplines and institutions in the U.S. Now, obviously, the work stems from an American perspective, but it is a very relevant and timely conversation for us to be having in the UK, given that there are ongoing and renewed conversations around race and how racism manifests itself in 21st century Britain. And we've had report after report in the past few years demonstrating the continued racial inequalities across all sectors of our society, from criminal justice to healthcare to employment to education. So it's imperative that we have this conversation and we think about the way in which we, our disciplines and our societal institutions are operating or attempting to operate on the basis of colorblindness, and what implications that has, what harm that might be causing, rather than actually helping to redress any inequalities. So without further ado, I will now introduce our panel. We have, I'll do it in order as it was there, rather than in order of your sitting, I'm afraid. We have Kimberly Crenshaw, who is professor of law at both Columbia University and UCLA. She is a leading expert on critical race theory, black legal feminist theory, racism and the law, amongst other fields, and has published widely across these areas. She is, of course, well known for her developing the theory of intersectionality, and she is co-founder of the African American Policy Forum. Luke Harris is professor of American politics and constitutional law at Vassar College, is also co-founder of the African American Policy Forum, is an expert in critical race theory, and has published widely on questions of racial and gender equality in contemporary America. And George Lipsitz is American Studies scholar and professor in the Department of Black Studies at the University of California, Santa Barbara. He is a leading scholar on social movements, urban culture inequalities, the politics of popular culture, and whiteness studies, and has written extensively across these areas, including having written a number of books. In terms of the format for this evening, I will effectively be handing over to our panelists, and they will be engaging in a conversation on this topic of countering colorblindness for approximately an hour, maybe a bit less. Sonia will then sort of draw together some of the key themes for that and questions we might be wanting to think about from a UK or a more local perspective, and we'll then open it up for questions from the audience, and we should hopefully have lots of time for questions and audience participation. Just a couple of housekeeping points before I hand over. First of all is fire exits. So in the unlikely case of an emergency, the fire alarm goes off, just note that there are exits at the back, and there's also an emergency exit there. And the assembly point is outside of the Student Union building on Sheffield Street. Mobile phones, so we would invite you to tweet about the event if you wish, but please keep your phones on silent. And finally, we are being recorded for a potential podcast, which would be released after the event, subject to there not being any technical issues. Okay, so that's it from me. I'm going to hand over to our panelists to start this conversation on countering colorblindness.
Great. Thank you. So first I want to start by thanking the law school, our host, for making this conversation possible. I also want to thank the Gender Institute here for having extended the invitation to be the Centennial Professor for the last 3.5 years. So this in some ways is our swan song. Being in this room is also a recovery of sorts. I'm so happy to see Claire Hemmings here, who has been my host for the last couple years, and also the superhero who intervened the last time I was giving a talk in this room against someone who decided that he thought he should be heard rather than me. So this is the best way to deal with trauma: come back with more people, stronger, readier. I don't think that's going to happen today. So thank you, Claire, for just everything. It's just been wonderful to have been here. So we thought that this might be a great opportunity to engage the law school and the study of law during this last stint here as the Centennial Professor. And the opportunity is also an occasion for us to celebrate the publication of a book that we have just published. It's called Seeing Race Again. Two of my co-authors are here, Luke Harris and George Lipsitz, and our third co-author, Danny Hosang, was with us for the last couple of days. Some of you who were at either of the events earlier this week got an opportunity to meet him. So we wanted to talk about the book as part of a larger set of projects that I'll just briefly describe and give you the objectives that we're hoping to achieve in this conversation. So the book, in a way, is a culmination of work that we have been doing both as academics and also as an organization. We here represent the African American Policy Forum. As you heard earlier, Luke is our co-founder, and George Lipsitz is our board chair. And the organization is basically designed to be a conduit for ideas and for necessary best practices in enhancing social justice advocacy in the social world. Our notion was that there are needs for greater collaboration, more robust interface between the worlds of social justice and the worlds that study questions having to do with race, gender, and other forms of inequality. And all too often, the boundaries between those worlds are so rigid that ideas and collaborations are far more difficult than they need to be in order to enact effective sharing and social justice advocacy. So much of our work is focused on responding to the rollback of civil rights advocacy in the United States. It's focused on resisting some of the mythology around affirmative action. It has also had global dimensions in our resisting colorblindness projects that have actually engaged colleagues, both social justice advocates and academics, in Brazil, in India, in South Africa, in France, and in the United States. So this work has been ongoing for at least 15 years, while at the same time we are academics, we write, we teach, we research. And increasingly it became important for us to more centrally integrate these practices and ideas in our own work. So we had the great opportunity in 2008 to all be fellows together. There's nothing like having an opportunity to go on sabbatical with your posse to think about what you need to be thinking about. So we had this opportunity at Stanford, and as part of that project, we were able to pull together other like-minded people who were really interested in thinking critically about social justice. They were interested in thinking critically about how their disciplines both contributed to the problem, but also might be able to develop tools to help us think creatively about resisting the dimensions of hierarchy and oppression that exist in our lives. The only question was, how could we find a way of talking collaboratively and productively about the problems that we were all interested in thinking about? This book is the culmination of that initial effort. So we want to tell you more about that effort, want to tell you more about the who, the why, the when, and the what. Let me say how we're going to do this conversation. So we are going to start by asking each other central questions to help explain what is the project and why we're doing the project. We are going to then move from the overall description of the project to trying to take apart the role of colorblindness in arresting the efforts to create more opportunity and social justice within a variety of institutions, but initially primarily within higher education. We're each going to talk a little bit about our own histories in higher education and how that led us to this work, and then we're going to talk about the implications of colorblindness in higher education for a range of other issues outside of the ivory tower. And in the process, we will be dismantling post-racialism and relocating intersectionality in critical race theory, which for reasons that we've talked about for the last couple days has sometimes dropped out of the narrative. So these are our objectives. We represent a variety of disciplines: sociology, black studies, history, music, and political science, and of course, law. So we're meaning this to be a transdisciplinary conversation with an idea to developing a transdisciplinary social project of countering colorblindness. So with that, I'm going to start with George, who I want to address the question of, what is the Colorblind Project? More importantly, why is it an important project for us to be pursuing in this particular moment? So what is it, why is it, and importantly, who is it?
Yeah. Well, we started out thinking about colorblindness as a tactical measure used to repress different campaigns for social justice. Excuse me. But we quickly saw it had a deeper meaning, that in many ways, colorblindness is the default position for social justice within law and with all of the disciplines, that each of the disciplines represented in our book, psychology, music, literary studies, history, legal studies, sociology, came into being at the moment of Europe's confrontations with peoples it thought of as other in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And the foundational premises of the Enlightenment come from an Immanuel Kant, the father of moral philosophy, who looked at a black man and said you could tell he was stupid because he was black from head to toe. The theory of history comes from G.W.F. Hegel, who said that Africa is no part of the modern world because it has no capability of or agency. The contract theory of liberty comes from a political scientist, John Locke, who had the leisure to write because his patron owned slaves. And so the founding theorist of liberty was philosophizing on money made from slave labor, and he argued that Africans had been captured in a just war. He argued that all people who are oppressed shouldn't complain, didn't have a right to complain, they should knuckle under. And in many ways, these are the core philosophers. Now, people in these disciplines say, you know, we no longer believe those things. But the question is, who frames the world in that way? What are the residual elements about sameness and difference that survive in the thinking of the West? Why is it that the notion of liberty and justice becomes an interchangeability in which everyone has to be the same, and that sameness is implicitly written as white and male? The closer you are to the white male norm, the freer, the more eligible for freedom you are. You're part of what Walter Mignolo calls humanitas, the people who are entitled to freedom and who run the world. And if you're not in that group, if you're part of what Dr. Du Bois called the common cause of the darker races, you're relegated to the area of anthropos. You're the people who do labor, but you don't get the benefit of it. You're the objects of knowledge, but not the subjects of it. And so we saw that deep within the disciplines, that the analysis that we have been taught to bring to issues of law, to issues of history, to issues of sociology, were already structured in dominance because we hadn't investigated the centrality of colorblindness, of sameness. Plato formulated something called the Great Chain of Being. And the Great Chain of Being acknowledges that there's a lot of difference in the world. But what Plato asks us to do is to say, whenever you find difference, you have to judge what's better than and what's worse than. You can never think about what's just different from. And this fear of difference produces educational institutions that are impoverished, that are deficient. We're not coming to the university as supplicants demanding entry into an already successful, flourishing enterprise. We come to the university recognizing its parochialism, recognizing that it's drawn its interlocutors from too narrow a range of social experiences. We come to the university recognizing that the demographics of the faculty, the demographics of the student body, the demographics of the syllabus and who it represents are artificially, arbitrarily, and unnecessarily constrained by racism, by sexism, by ableism, by the histories of indigenous dispossession and slavery unwilling to die. So in many ways, we see ourselves as the quality control arm of the academy. We're saving it from its parochialism. And in this book, we wanted to create a handbook that would enable people to critique their disciplines. And we have studies in here by an indigenous anthropologist looking at the way anthropology has constructed indigenous peoples. We have an essay by Lauren Kajikawa talking about the ways in which the distinction between music and musicology is an innately racist definition that attaches culture to some people and not to others. But we also have projects like Fia Salter and Glenn Adams who are thinking about what would psychology be if it was freed from colorblindness? What would a color-conscious psychology be? How could we find colorblind remedies to what are, in fact, color-brown problems? So it's a dual project. We want to talk about what the disciplines obscure, but we also have models of how people have used the disciplines, have troubled them with a race-conscious way of looking at things that have made them better, that have produced new knowledge, that have expanded the sphere of evidence, that have enabled people of color not to be witnesses whose testimony is ruled inadmissible even before they speak, but to be the producers of knowledge by talking about the broader framework in which we all live. So we critique rights. We critique the university, we live within rights, we live within the university, but we can't fail to engage. And we have some models of scholars here in the book and on the panel who I think have thought about these things in ways that'll be useful to share. So I want to ask questions of both Kim and Luke about not only their contributions to this book, but the evolution of their thought that has made countering colorblindness central to what they're dealing with. And so for Kim, you know, Kim, you have two chapters in this book. One talks about the ways in which critical race theory emerged as a project of unmasking colorblindness at the heart of legal liberalism. And so even in the 1980s, when you were formulating critical race theory, it was immediately evident even then that colorblindness was not a form of justice, but rather a way of inhibiting it. You sometimes talk about it as a rhetorical prophylactic designed more to prevent something than to produce something. And so if you could talk about that, and in your other essay in the book, you talk about colorblindness in the age of Obama. So it's clear those seeds are not just on the right. They didn't go away. They still continue. So if you could speak to that, that would open the door for Luke to talk about the ways in which the baseline standards of merit that are used to justify colorblindness are the products, you know, not of fitness, but of favoritism. And the complaints of reverse discrimination, as Luke has often argued, are really manifestations of the trauma of diminished overrepresentation from groups that have been dominant. So, Kim, could you start with talking about colorblindness as central to your project?
Thank you, George. So, one part of the civil rights movement historically in the 1960s that has been underappreciated has been the struggle over knowledge production, the power that comes from having the capacity to actually be producers of knowledge rather than the objects of knowledge. By that I mean the struggles over, say, voting, the struggles over employment, those are often remembered as key moments in the civil rights struggle in the United States. But equally contested and, in fact, equally bloody was the struggle over access to higher education. That's just not often remembered. And there are a couple reasons that might be the case. Number one, we tend not to think about racial power as being expressed in institutions like this. We think about racial power as happening out there, somewhere else, not here. Secondly, the notions about what qualifies people to participate in institutions like this actually fall back on hierarchies around race and its a relationship to cognition and intelligence that were not as central as in voting and in employment as they might be here. The last thing in the United States in particular is that race was largely projected as a problem of the South, not a problem of the North, not a problem of the East, not a problem of highfalutin institutions like these. So while we have villains in our story about racial injustice that involved individuals who beat voters who were trying to vote, we don't remember presidents of higher education and deans of law schools in the same rhetorical register. So as a consequence, the story about the struggle for inclusion, the struggle for changing the terms of what these institutions do is not well remembered. And because it's not well remembered, some of the products of those struggles are disconnected from the history that produced them. So critical race theory is one of those ideas, intersectionality, a part of those ideas that's disconnected from the history out of which these ideas emerged. So the short of the story might be something like this. In the second generation after the white-only signs collapsed in the U.S., a generation of students went into professional schools. They went into these professional schools having been shaped by the politics in their undergraduate environment, which included protesting for ethnic studies courses that eventually became protests for gender studies courses and queer theory. And out of those habits of struggle, going to professional schools, many of us arrived saying, okay, where are the courses on race discrimination? Where are the courses on race, racism, and American law? Some of us went directly to Harvard Law School because there had been someone there, Derek Bell, who taught a course about race, racism, and American law. Our objective was to become the lawyers of the next generation Commission who would go forward and try to figure out ways of deepening law's commitment to dismantling white supremacy. But when we got there, Derrick Bell had just left, and our deans basically told us they had no plans to teach these courses anymore. They weren't foundational to the study of law. And if we wanted to learn these things, we should just go get a placement in legal services and take a couple of advanced courses. Our response to that was punctuated by the last thing the dean said, which was, there are no qualified black people who can come and teach this course anywhere in the United States. And wouldn't you prefer an excellent white professor to a mediocre black one? Now, what that did for us was set the terms of the debate. It was basically like a picture. The picture was virtually no people of color teaching in these institutions, and then the rationalization for it, which was there are none qualified. Now, what was so fascinating was that there was a conflict between the fact that students were gaining access to these institutions, so the institution was willing to diversify the student body, but they were not willing to diversify the faculty. So there was something amiss in this tension, and the response allowed us to begin to interrogate, well, what are the terms by which people are deemed to be qualified? How can people be seen as being qualified when effectively they did nothing for the last two centuries to shift the law so that the law wasn't an author of white supremacy all throughout society? So that was the predicate for the beginning of the process that led us to critical race theory. And for my next question, I'll do more of that later.
So Luke, why don't you talk to us about your long engagement with what you call diminished overrepresentation.
Okay,
the best black.
I'll give an attempt at that. You know, I want to talk to you as a first-generation beneficiary of affirmative action in the United States. I was born in 1950, started elementary school the year after the Brown case, which desegregated public schools in the United States. Now, of course, it desegregated schools in theory. I didn't grow up in the South. I grew up in South Jersey, and the school that I went to until I was 10 years old was a deeply segregated school. I happened to be born, though, at a time that when 1968 happened, there was a movement in the courts to end apartheid in the United States. There was a movement in the streets. And in 1968, both Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King were assassinated. And in the wake of those two assassinations, there were urban rebellions across the country. And it was in that context that race-based affirmative action started. And then it was in 1968 that I graduated from high school and went to college. You know, and my interest in these issues grows out of my experiences in college and graduate and professional school. I have to say, in college, I experienced institutional racism without knowing what it was, right? Without, you know, just knowing that something doesn't feel right. But I'm not quite sure what it is, although I was being told that what it was people like me and other people who were benefiting from this program. So these interests, you know, really pushed me when I was in college, and I went off to Yale Law School thinking about equal protection problems. And, you know, I was, again, you know, like the first generation of affirmative action admits at Yale. Before our generation, they had a history of bringing in six or seven blacks a year, and nobody at Yale opposed that. Right, that was kind of noblesse oblige. That was considered a certain kind of favoritism, and nobody—not the conservatives, not the moderates, not the liberals—had a problem with that. We came in and we said, you know, we think we have a right to be here. Right? It's not a system of favoritism. We think we ought to question some of the criteria that you're using that represent meritocracy, and that created a problem. Right? So one of the things that we noticed was that every year, 17 black students were coming into Yale Law School. So we said after the third year, well, let's push back against this, right? And let's push back in a way that kind of melded with Yale's elitism, but we didn't know how elitist Yale was. Well, what did we do? Well, we went back over the last 5 years and found a group of Black Rhodes Scholars that had been rejected at Yale Law School, had subsequently gone to Harvard Law School and graduated. And so we thought, well, okay, we'll introduce this as as evidence that you're missing people, because we were trying to get two people off the wait list. One was a high honors graduate from Yale who was a Rhodes Scholar, and the other was a Black man who just finished a PhD in anthropology. So we're talking to the dean of the law school as a multiracial group of us that have gone into the dean's office, and we're talking about what it would mean, right, to go to this wait list. And I'll never forget what he said to me. He said, because I was chairman of the Black Student Union, and he said, Harvard, it's a good school. The top half of Harvard is kind of like us. But the bottom half of Harvard is a shambles. So it doesn't mean anything if we reject somebody and they go to Harvard Law School. And then we realized, okay, their elitism is profound, right? Right? And he went around the room, right? There were Latino students in this room. There were Asian American students. There were Black indigenous students. And he says, but you and you and you, right? You're the best people of color in the country, right? But it became clear to us that the best Blacks and the best people of color in the country were a very different group of people than what were considered the best in the country, right? And so we couldn't get, right, a student off of that wait list. Now, you know, it's 40 years since then, right? What happened to some of those students on that wait list? Well, the Rhodes Scholar, 25 years later, became a board of trustee member at Yale, right? So obviously he had the potential, but there was no place for him because of a vision of meritocracy that was inappropriate. I'm going to go on a little further.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so look. That led me to Princeton, right? Because I thought, you know, look, I'm going to do a PhD and think about these issues. And I'm going to take a little bit more than 10 seconds. I'm going to take about 6 or 7 minutes, right? This is what I'm going to do, right?
Start the clock again.
I'm into this shit now, right? So, you know, I went to Yale to write about affirmative action, right? And I was working with not a conservative, but a liberal, one of the most famous of American liberal constitutional political science guys who do constitutional law. And I'm out at lunch with him one day talking about the first chapter of my dissertation, which is a chapter called Notes from a Child of Apartheid, because I grew up on welfare. I grew up in an apartheid system. And he looks at me and he says, you know, in this chapter, you seem to be calling white people racist. And I'm thinking, like, well, I'm writing about white supremacy, so there's something to that, right, right, right. But, you know, look, that's when I began to see, look, there are parameters even within the context of liberalism to the kind of work that you want to do, right? And it made me think about a lot of things. Like, for example, the debate that I was interested in, this affirmative action debate, you know, so many Americans who are against affirmative action, they know reverse discrimination when they see it. How do they know it when they see it? I mean, I have to study a situation to understand whether or not there's a question of equal protection. But how do they know it when they see it? Well, you know, they use a kind of superficial, parochial conceptualization. It's an offshoot of the Aristotelian conception of discrimination. I know discrimination when I see some people treated differently than others. The assumption is, like, that people are similarly situated in contemporary America. And so if you treat some people differently than others, you're involved in a process of discrimination. So, you know, I'm at Princeton, I'm thinking, okay, well, let me think about where would this version of equal protection work? And you know, I came up with something, right? In the kingdom of heaven, right, where, you know, you have a beloved community throughout all time, you can assume that across all sectors of the heavenly community, a beloved community, that people are similarly situated. But what are we debating in the United States and across the world when it comes to affirmative action? Well, first of all, it's a discourse on the planet Earth. And in this case, it's a discourse, right? It's a discourse about the United States. So what's different, right, about the United States than the kingdom of heaven? Well, the three worst forms of racial subordination were practiced for centuries, right? So what is that? Genocide of indigenous people, slavery for African Americans, apartheid for a century for all people of color, illegal until after I started school, right? Tax laws and immigration laws and foreign minors taxes, right, that discriminated in all kinds of ways, right? So what does that leave us with, right? Why is there this sense that reverse discrimination is such a big problem? And I want to suggest to you it's because American society, for one, it's a post-apartheid society that doesn't, that's never acknowledged it's a post-apartheid society. It's a majority white post-apartheid society where people are, where white folk are used to having all of the key positions across all sectors of society. So, right, when you introduce race-based programs that remove unwarranted obstacles, even as people of color remain significantly underrepresented, right, it's considered as though they're taking away something from whites, right? And they are taking away something from whites. They're taking away a form of privilege that never should have existed, right? 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 This is what I call diminished overrepresentation. Look, you probably have read about the major Supreme Court cases that deal with affirmative action in the United States. This is front page news. This is front page news in the New York Times, in the Wall Street Journal, in the Washington Post. But what are these cases really about? Right? These cases are white rights cases. Right? These cases have nothing to do with the Brown case. Right? So people of color, black people in particular, are considered to be the face of these cases, but they're neither the plaintiffs nor the defendants in these cases. And that creates a real problem, right? Because there's no one involved with these cases that are really, that's really arguing the strongest positions to defend affirmative action, right? Affirmative action winds up being a discourse about whether or not damaged individuals in search of preferences ought to be given them, rather than a focus on damaged institutions, right, that are in need of repair in the post-apartheid era. And I'll just leave you with this. From our perspective, it's really important to go from one sector to the next, from one institution to the next, and deal with, right, the conceptions of meritocracy that were developed during the era of apartheid and racial apartheid. And so what does that mean? You have to think about the kinds of things that get put on the table by people when they're claiming reverse discrimination. So if we get, if we look outside of institutions of higher education and then look at fire departments in Los Angeles, there are whites fire persons who were claiming that moving away from the height and weight requirements, right, was reverse discrimination against them. Now, those height and weight requirements, they meant that a lot of women couldn't be fire persons. They meant that a lot of Asian Americans couldn't be fire persons. And so that just made me think. I don't think I'm a genius, but I thought, well, China, they have fires, don't they? Do they get a plane from England to fly to China to put out their fire? I don't think so, right? 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 But we have a situation, right, where the institutional practices that were put in place during the era of apartheid, no one would expect them to have been designed to decipher what it means to include people that are at that moment suffering and enduring racial subordination. But it is those practices, right, that have been moved into the post-apartheid era. It is those things that people are defending, and it is what we push back against.
You want to ask Kim about intersectionality?
So, we push back against this in a way that really is a deep reflection of what it means to have an intersectional perspective. And Kim, I think it would be really useful if you could talk to us about the way in which intersectionality relates to the work that we do, the way it relates to critical race theory, the way it relates to the practice of the day-to-day work of the policy forum.
So thank you, Luke, for passing that baton. So I think what I want to do is back up a little bit and pick up some themes that you talked about and link it to how colorblindness is a shield to obscure the operation of white and male supremacy as meritocratic. because both of those things were playing a role in justifying faculty hiring that was 100% white male precisely at the time that the new generation was coming in and demanding something else. So as I left off, I had just mentioned that the dean had basically said that there weren't any qualified people that could come and teach the courses that we wanted to be taught. At the same time, the university was going about its regular hiring practices, and that very year, it hired 10 white men. So there weren't any white women that were qualified and no people of color who were qualified. That clearly directed our attention to how was this justified. And the way it was justified was basically to say this is meritocratic, and meritocratic is neither raced nor gendered. It just is what it is. So then we decided, well, let's see what is, right? What counts as meritocratic, particularly in an institution that has a history of explicit exclusion, both on the basis of race and gender. What counts as meritocratic? Well, partly what counts as meritocratic is, are you part of a pipeline that's partly constituted by having a biography that meant that you or someone like you had access to that institution for its entire life? So many of the people who were hired were people who had come through Harvard or who had clerked for or were legal associates of people who had a toehold in that institution. The thought that at this moment in history, when the explicit exclusion of women and earlier than that people of color was now recognized as an illegitimate exclusion generally, but the consequences of that exclusion for who now is seen as meritocratic just wasn't part of their consciousness. It wasn't a significant interruption of their reliance on meritocracy. Then we went even deeper. Well, so what actually counts? What counts is being admitted to an elite law school. What counts is being on the law review. What counts is publishing pieces that, for the most part, have nothing to do with some of the social justice issues that were associated with the new populations that were coming into those schools. So there was desegregation for the students, but no desegregation of the curriculum, no desegregation of what the role of the law school was, no desegregation of what counts as legitimate knowledge. So we had old ideas about merit being projected far into the future, and no one seemed to see that as critically important to disentangle and to dismantle. So critical race theory came out of that. What we decided to do as students is to stop begging the school to give us the education that we were paying for. We decided that we were going to aggregate our resources as students, identify those scholars of color across the country who we believed were qualified, and bring them to the law school. They came for a week each. They taught a chapter out of Derrick Bell's book. Many of our progressive allies, white critical legal studies people, gave us independent study credit for taking this course. So we called it literally the alternative course. Those who participated in that alternative course, both the students as well as the young faculty who came in, they were the first cohort called critical race theorists. So 5 years later, we all came together and said, what is it that held us together? What is it that we learned from that interaction with the institution? How did we interrogate the way that colorblindness was rationalizing racial exclusionary process of admissions? These were all the questions that together helped us create some of the initial texts that became critical race theory. Now, the AAPF has tried to take some of those ideas and make them more accessible to a wider community. So one of the things that we created was something called the unequal opportunity race. And it's responding to a couple things. One, we're trying to make clear that being attentive to racial barriers is not discrimination. In fact, not being attentive to those barriers is discrimination. As Luke was saying, the Aristotelian idea about equality suggests that if you treat people who are similarly situated differently, that's discrimination. The flip side, though, is if you treat people who are dissimilarly situated as though they are the same, that is discrimination. So how could we make these ideas more relevant, more accessible to the broader community? Many people who are themselves beneficiaries of affirmative action, but because they've been told that they benefited from reverse discrimination, were not available to be recruited to establish and expand these important social justice interventions. So we came up with this video, and I'm going to tell you a story after you watch it about how it was received in Rico County, Virginia. For many of you who are from the United States, you know that that's the cradle of the old Confederacy. If there is a state of white supremacy in the United States, it would be Richmond, Virginia. But for now, take a look at this.
Come on.
So that's called the unequal opportunity race. You can find it on YouTube. It's been viewed a couple million times. It was shown a couple years ago at a high school Black History Month event. One student saw it and went home and told his grandfather, her grandfather, who was a stringer for Fox News. Fox News picked it up and called it a white guilt video, which then created a backlash against the video, which ultimately led to the school board banning the video in school because it was, as they said, racist as opposed to egalitarian. And what was racist about it? Racist was that it attended to, it told a story about race, it made race continuously relevant, and it created resentment on the part of students of color, and that in itself is racist. So this is an extension of colorblindness. It gives you a sense of the political work that colorblindness does, and it's not colorblind political work. It's using colorblindness as a shield to suppress discourse about the continuing significance of race in American society.
And this is in a city that has statues commemorating the Confederacy and Confederate generals.
So I'm going to flip it back to George, and George, I'm going to extend the question that Luke asked me so that you can pick up on two things, namely the social justice work that the Policy Forum is doing and how it embodies an intersectional framework that comes from a critical race theory lens.
Our work started out because of the inadequacy of the liberal legalism in relation to civil rights law, where you could find an individual intentional act of discrimination by one perpetrator against one victim that disequilibrates the world, and then you get restitution and you bring the person is made whole, you come back to normal. But if racism and other forms of subordination are collective, cumulative, and continuing, there is no originary moment to go back to. There is no one individual isolated instant. Every instance adds itself on to a long history, a long train of abuses and indignities. And so part of what we try to argue is try to see things structurally, systemically, collectively, but also to see that these things don't happen to people one group at a time. You discriminate against the disabled. People who are disabled are also queer, also black. You discriminate against blacks, men, you end that discrimination, you may not be helping black women. There's a way in which we need to have a more intersectional understanding of the nature of currents of power and how they work. A friend of ours named Jerome Smith is a freedom fighter in New Orleans, Louisiana. When Jerome used to go into the civil rights struggle in Mississippi, where he was jailed, where he was beaten, where he saw homes bombed and burned, Jerome Smith used to go to a cafe in the 7th Ward in New Orleans, the Trumaine neighborhood. He went to the jukebox and put in his dime and played a song called "The Danger Zone Is Everywhere." The Ray Charles song that says, a Percy Mayfield song that Ray Charles sang. It said, "The danger zone is everywhere. It's in the academy, it's in the universities, it's in the police department, it's in the hiring office, it's in the mass media." And so we need to have a way to speak to the totality of those existences, of those acts of discrimination. Now, for those of you too young to know what a jukebox was, I guess I should say that it was an entertainment mechanism back in what historians refer to as the pre-Spotify era of human history. But that message of it, that the danger zone is everywhere, speaks to the work that we do. So we believe that the type of change we're interested in requires the participation of a whole people. It can't be done from the library or the classroom podium, from your armchair. It can't be tweeted into existence. It has to be masses in motion, mobilized for self-determination and self-defense. And so we've organized projects like Her Dream Deferred, in which we look at the systemic undercapitalization, the economic austerity that black women constantly face, the artificial impediments to accumulating assets that appreciate in value. We've had some 15 and growing Say Her Name forums around the country, in which we ask black women to come forward and testify. Initially, we were interested mostly in victims of police violence, because the very proper righteous movement against police violence was portraying it as if only males were being killed. And we knew about Rekia Boyd and Tanisha Anderson and Sandra Bland and so many others. And we've been working with the mothers of black women and girls who have been murdered by the police, because it's not only that we want to call attention to this violence, we have to think about what would be a remedy, what would be a repair, how do we bring a community together. The mother of one of the murdered young women said, "I lost my daughter, but I found so many sisters." And what she finds with these sisters in these meetings are black women talking about police violence, partner violence, the violence of hunger, homelessness, housing insecurity, and trying to formulate solutions, giving testimony. Kim's argument always is, we can't wait for the government. We can't wait for the foundations. Nobody's going to do for us what we fail to do for ourselves. And so we create these situations. We try to create a new polity to produce new politics to bring about a change in this society by listening to the voices of those that are systematically left out of the academy and the places of policy making. And yet, in our society, black women are the eyewitnesses to so many of the depredations that need to be cured. If you want to find a cure, we should talk to the people who have firsthand knowledge, and their survival skills, we believe, can be the basis for a correction that'll produce a new society. But even in those settings, we need to contend with the tremendous propaganda, the tremendous information apparatus that shames people from saying that they've suffered from these injuries, shames them from talking out openly about social justice, and hides from them what organized action has done for them. And this is something I want to ask Luke about. Luke teaches about affirmative action and confronts the invisibility of the gains of the freedom movement every day.
Okay. You know, I want to talk a little bit, just a little bit, about some of the things that students in my environment take for granted. And, you know, one of those things, I teach at a college that was formerly a women's college. It's a Vassar College in Poughkeepsie, New York. Gender studies, for example, women's studies, for example, it's taken for granted in that context. I ask my students, though, when did gender studies become something that was widely a function of American universities, right? And they'll, and you know, so they don't really have a sense of that, right? And so I'll say, well, do you think it was there in the early 20th century? Was it there in the mid-20th century? You think maybe, well, let's say in 1920, some of the liberal constitutional law professors who were sending their kids to schools like Bryn Mawr and Vassar, their female students, do you think they thought, well, you know, maybe we should bring gender studies, maybe we should bring women's studies into our environment because our daughters can't even vote? Right, but what you see is that for the first 7 to 8 decades, well, for the first 7 decades of the 20th century, those kinds of conversations never happened. Right? How did women's studies, how did black studies, how did these programs develop? They developed in the post-civil rights era, once those of us that had been kept out of these institutions had a chance, right, to become a part of these institutions and use those institutions to do new things. I ask my students, I ask my freshman students every year in my Intro to American Politics course, well, what do you know you know, and what have been your experiences about, you know, with affirmative action? And they'll say, well, you know, I've heard that it's reverse discrimination. I've heard that it's benign discrimination. I'm kind of for it or I'm not. I've heard that it hurts some people. I've heard that it might hurt me. And so I'll say to them, well, what positive experiences have you had with affirmative action? And uniformly they say, well, we haven't had any personal, any positive experiences, right? So I'm feeling bad about that because I'm thinking, well, first of all, I'm teaching you, right? And I'm a beneficiary of affirmative action. So they don't recognize that, right? They don't recognize who I am and what my relationship is to them. But going beyond that, they don't recognize, right, the way in which race-based programs have a way of creating new knowledge. It's a knowledge production factory. So these same students who are saying to me, I've had no positive experience, right, with affirmative action, are the ones that are coming up to me saying, wow, I really love Kimberly Crenshaw's work. Right? And I'm thinking, well, do you realize that her work, right, it's a function of the possibilities that were created by race-based programs, that she could produce a type of knowledge that in the first nine decades of the 20th century would not come out of this academy, right? But so we don't even have a way of engaging a discourse around affirmative action that speaks to of the way in which it is affecting the lives of people across this country, right? I mean, across the United States, and for that matter, across the world. And we need to enlarge that debate, and we need to understand that it has an impact not just in universities, but it has it. When I was growing up, black people, brown people, Asian people couldn't work on construction crews. They couldn't work in police departments. They couldn't work in fire departments. We don't have a real grip on what it means to grow out of a post-apartheid society or understand the impact of what it means to have race-conscious programs to push back against a society that has never been egalitarian. And with that, I really would like to turn things over to our host.
I think we've got more here. No?
That's
okay.
Yes, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you very much. That was really interesting, and I'm sure that there'll be an opportunity for you to speak more on this with questions. So I'm going to keep my comments really short because I'm sure you don't really want to hear from me. You want to hear more from them. So what I'll do is kind of just draw out some perhaps themes and thoughts that I had, and then we'll take questions from the audience. So perhaps if we take three questions at a time, and hopefully we can fit a few of those in. One of the things that really struck me when all three panel members were speaking was that even though on the face of it we think that America and England are quite different, actually there are a lot of similarities that seem to be coming up in the way in which race and racism seems to manifest. And as I was watching that video, it really struck me and made me think about, you know, things like the attainment gap, things like the fact that, you know, there are 25 black female professors and less than 100 black men. I think I saw something the other day on Twitter about the fact that more black women are dying within England in terms of healthcare and things, or the poor healthcare that they're receiving. Even though, again, to sort of reiterate, even though the contexts are so different, what is it that causes these similarities to kind of manifest themselves? And really, I think we can't get away from the fact that it is about race and racism. And, you know, in thinking about England, you can't separate it from the kind of colonial history and the sort of constructions of race and, you know, of races as kind of the savage other. You know, it's, you know, the sort of... you know, Mill, Locke, Bentham, and George alluded to this. They're the so-called founding fathers of liberal theory. They're how we do rights, how we do democracy, how we do law. And the kind of idea of the liberal individual really finds itself in, I think is reflected in the notion of the formal liberal subject. It's abstract, it's characteristicless, it's neutral, it's genderless, but it's raceless. But actually, we all know that it's not. And then we then see that when we think about the disproportionate stop and search of, you know, black and Asian men, for example. And so for me, this whole question of color blindness, I don't think is specific to America. I think this is just the way that, perhaps if I can say, the West does race and sees race. And I guess some of the, let's say, kind of issues that I, you know, that kind of flagged up to me were thinking about, you know, if we're thinking about the academy, and again, a lot of it sort of reiterates what they were talking about. that recruitment practices here don't take account of all the inequalities at each stage, at school, at, you know, further education, at higher education, the lack of mentoring, the lack of support, you know, the way that certain, and I think they said certain voices, certain accents, certain, you know, ways of speaking are seen to be less. Then, and that, of course, then impacts on who's going into postgraduate study and who's then able to get a PhD and then make their way into the so-called elite institutions. Because, of course, if you are a person of color writing on race and commenting critically on race, you're not going to get published in the so-called elite journals, which then, of course, acts as a kind of obstacle to your access to those institutions. And you know, I think if we look around at those elite institutions, they're predominantly white. And if what we want to do is to say, actually, we need to interrogate our recruitment practices, that's a very uncomfortable conversation for some people to have. It means going, am I a racist? No one really wants to say that. And I think that it's what we kind of have to think about then is who's going to, you know, and this sort of comes up with the decolonizing the curriculum. It's a great movement, but again, requires those uncomfortable conversations. And my concern, my worry is, how do we have those conversations? How do we interrogate who's recruiting who and, you know, who's at the top without the burden of that falling on people of color? Because when you raise these issues, you are angry, you are aggressive, you're ungrateful, and you should just shut up and put up. And, you know, again, you know, we're not, and of course, I think for me, the thing about colorblindness is that it's always seen to be this defense. We're not racist. We don't see color. Well, I'm glad you cannot see color, but we do. you know, so I guess those, you know, it's for me, and, you know, always thinking about, you know, the academic institution, because that's where we work and that's where we live. It's that sort of idea that knowledge and knowledge production, as they mentioned, you know, is being kind of the access to that and to kind of defining and understanding that is being blocked. You know, certain people are the gatekeepers to what constitutes knowledge and how we understand that. And, you know, perhaps it's a bit pessimistic of me to say so, but it seems to me that the US is actually kind of further ahead than we are in sort of unlocking those gates, as it were. So these were just some of my thoughts. And I guess the kind of the last one really that I had is that if we're going to think about how we can kind of dismantle these racism, these racist structures, and it sort of strikes me that, you know, that's the quote, can we use the master's tools to dismantle the master's house, or do we have to come up with something else? Because they talked about mass mobilization, but how do we do that? I'm not sure that we have the same power or presence as they do in the U.S. And as I said, I don't mean to be pessimistic, but just keeping it real. So, you know, I'm going to hand it over to you. You may have thoughts on this or perhaps other questions that you'd like to raise. So please do put your hand up as high as you can, and we'll take your answer. So I'll go with the first three, if yourself, and then you and you. Sorry, if you wait for the mic.
Hello, my name is, can you hear me?
Yeah.
My name is Millie. My name is Millie, and I just wanted to say thank you very much, panel, for your talk. Really enjoyed it. I'm here to testify from academia. I come from the streets. I was brought up in South London, raised on a council estate and all the rest of it, and I managed, to cut a long story short, I managed to submit my PhD last month. Thank you very much. On time, no drama. I just did what I needed to do. And I suffered a lot of what you were describing, a lot of mm-hmm. weirdness and stuff. Mm-hmm. And what helped me to get through it, I just had to go back to what I know, which is the streets, which is my family, Jamaican spirit, and that's what got me through it. I just thought, fuck all of you lot. I know what I come here for, and I'll be fucking damned if... Anyway, so, you know, and I've got... And I wrote my dissertation about my reality, my history, and everything. And I don't care if they don't even, you know, put it in the library. I don't give a fuck. But I did what I needed to do. And I'm very proud of what I've written, and I'd be very happy to share it with you guys and get some feedback. That would be so cool. But I am not taking no prisoners. You know, my ancestors have suffered. What I'm trying to say is we have power. The fact that we are still here and we get together, the more of us that get together, discuss, debate, and put this stuff in the academia, that's the power, that's the strength. And they're terrified. I mean, they're shit scared. Me, one black woman, submitting on time. They're freaking out down there. They really are. So what I'd like to say to everybody here is we can all do it if we just keep pushing and working. The work is the key, the work. They can tell you and, you know, try and piss you off and everything, but when you're throwing down work, what are they going to do? You know, you just have to keep throwing down the work, and that's what I want to continue to do. So I need mentors. I need support now. I'm doing my bit, and I just need a bit of help from any academic, any student is power for me. When I'm walking around academia and I see students and I see staff, that's what keeps me going as well. So the fact that everybody is here, we're doing it. You're doing it. You're showing up. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, panel. Hi, my name is Ronks. I'm actually a medical doctor. I'm a... Thank you. I had two questions. There are more points. Sorry, I know there's people really annoying, but that's me today. There's one point is, yes, the master's tools cannot break down the master's house. Now, when we were talking about us mobilizing, a friend said to me that as black people, we're often, and there are many reasons why, we're often surviving, living in a survival mode. Like, we're always told there's only space for one of us at the table, so we're all competing with each other to be that one, you know, the golden black person. And it happens, it's like an insidious behavior that we learn from when we're little, and it goes into academia and into job places, etc., etc. We want to be the best black person. I have erred away from that. Being a doctor, I have lots of responsibility. I have lots of junior doctors under me. And I think things are happening. An example being Black Pride, and I know that's not in academia, but for a very long time, the founder of Black Pride, which is Lady Phil, she's a Ghanaian older woman. She was always asking, regular Pride, give us space, you know, us minorities, us BAME people, we need space. Never. Pride is always whitewashed. It's always surrounded by white people and their straight friends having lots and lots of fun and dancing our dance moves back to us. UK Black Pride has its... But the UK Black Pride, after years and years being this little thing in Vauxhall Park, is now massive, and people are coming from all over the world to come to Black Pride. So I personally, as somebody who centres black and majority ethnic people in my practice, and I don't do it in a way that, white folks say they can say what they want, but I make sure that I centre the needs of people that look like me. So for example, we can all do it in our daily practices. If there are people we work with, if there are people at our unis that look like us, or you've got some sort of intersectionality that you feel that you connect with, make friends. Because I think as black people, and correct me if I'm wrong, we're not very good at just going up to each other and saying, hey, do you need any help? Or you look nice today, or I like your shoes. We need to be doing more of that before we start saying we're going to go into academia and break down and tell the white people that we need this, we need more, we need that. We just need to be kind to each other. And I do believe it can happen. I'm a product of that. I'm the first black medical TV doctor. You can see me on CBBC. I think, but being that, sorry, I'm just picking myself up now, but being in that role means that I can throw open the door and bring my people. And that's exactly what I'm going to do, because guess what? Everybody else is doing it. So we need to stop feeling guilty, stop acting on survival mode, stop thinking only one of us can exist in whichever sphere. We can all exist together. We just need to be kind to each other and make those opportunities happen. I'm very sorry.
We have to keep things quick. Okay, sorry. Can I just say, we do want to give everyone space to speak and say their thing, but if you can keep it concise and a question towards our panel, would be appreciated. Thank you. It's okay.
That's sorry.
Can you hear me?
Sorry.
Hi. Person.
Yeah. Yes, hello. I will do my best to be considerate around time. I must say, no, that's not shade. I promise. I must say that I am feeling quite emotional right now. So I go here, I'm doing my master's in anthropology, and I've never been in a room this black at this institution. So it's kind of overwhelming. And particularly because I came to write about affirmative action and was told by a very respected scholar that there is no anthropology of affirmative action. So this moment here is just really personally affirming. I do have a question. So my name is Lerato. I'm from South Africa, is interesting because we're somehow both a rainbow nation and colorblind at the same time. So that's interesting. But my question is around reckoning with power and what that looks like, particularly outside of the law and outside of academia. So some of the work that I do back home is around trying to facilitate more informed discussions around our experiences. And more often than not, those discussions are derailed by, quite frankly, white fragility and white tears. What I've done now is have a separate facilitator to first help them process that, and then we can come and have that conversation. But as black women, we're both cast as too strong, so you're the one that made the delicate white woman cry, and also too weak. So part of the project is to gather the lived experiences of young black professional women in corporate South Africa and talk about just how far we have to go. But my concern is around, you know, us not re-victimizing ourselves, both in the experience and in then being seen as victims again, if that makes sense. So what does that reckoning of power look like when you're somehow too strong and too weak at the same time? Thank you.
A good question. Ooh, wow. So I want to read that as soon as you finish it. I'm going to take the derailing of the conversation part of it, and I think on the question of being able to pursue your project in an environment that has not set up the conditions for it. I'm going to turn to Luke, and on the question of the anthropology of, I think that's brilliant. I would love to see that. I was just sharing before we came out. So this is maybe the third or fourth time we have had a conversation in another country to contextualize critical race theory, to talk about colorblindness, its operation as a framework and a discourse for positioning whiteness as the center of institutions. And there's always a story about what happens when we do it in another country. So we have a South Africa story, too. So we came to South Africa around the time of the new constitution. I've been doing some work there on the constitution, and this was a meeting of South African judges. And of course, there are a lot of questions about how to think about a new regime that comes in the aftermath, supposedly, of a deconstructed apartheid regime. And the funny thing is, we had been talking about this moment for a long time. It was one of the best lines that we used to have in fighting back against people who were against affirmative action, who would say, well, you know, we don't discriminate against anymore, you know, you don't need affirmative action. And we used to say, before the new South Africa, well, what would happen if tomorrow Nelson Mandela walked out of jail, right? And would you be saying, well, we don't need to have any race conscious anything because, well, we don't do that anymore? And it used to be the killer line. People would go, oh yeah, that's really stupid to think that we don't need to talk about race the moment Nelson Mandela walks out of prison. Well, so there we are in South Africa, the moment after Nelson Mandela walks out of prison. We are talking about what happens after the formal dimensions of white supremacy supposedly collapse. Like, what are the structures that are still in place that have to be interrogated, rethought, reconstructed? What are all those things? So we're talking about it just, here was our experience. Take what you will of it and discard what's not significant or on point. So we give this talk. When it's over, the white people in the room come after us hard. Like, the issue in South Africa is not race. We don't have a racial problem in South Africa. We're like, what? You know, we don't have a racial problem. And it went on to, you black Americans, you're going to ruin what's going on here in South Africa. We're not having it. You know, sort of the whole finger wag and everything. We were like, whoa, people talk to each other like that here. I mean, really, white people talk to black people like that in South, you know, really? And it was fascinating to us because it told us a couple things, that formal institutional power doesn't necessarily change the terms of interpersonal power relationships. White supremacy finds expression in any number of ways. So yes, it's partly formal, but it's also interactive. It's when can the group be spoken for, and when can conversations be cut off and stopped, and when they can't be. Are there words to say back to that expression, you know, of authority and control that still is racialized? It was like, wow, we went from thinking, gee, it sure would be great to be the majority for once, to seeing, well, no matter what, white supremacy finds a way of expressing itself, whether you're a majority black nation, minority nation, whether it's an institution that's traditionally exclusive or not. The technologies of white supremacy are numerous. And our challenge is to figure out how to consistently market, how to interrogate it, how to legitimize the marking and interrogation as intellectual projects as well as political projects. So it's not surprising that your project is reflecting a struggle to get it going. That's also the hint that there's a there. Right? That's telling you. So when people say, well, there are no projects, there's no anthropology of affirmative action. Well, that's kind of what I was told when it's like, well, there's no such thing as intersectionality. That's telling you, okay, I need to dig deeper. So think of that as your Geiger counter. Like, you go across the social terrain, there's things that you want to write about, and people are like, we don't have any of that. That's a clue to you that, okay, this is an artifact of our disappearance in this institution. This is where I need to dig and find the people that will help you dig it.
Yeah. Yeah. I just want to say a word about the specificity of anthropology here. And it's similar to other disciplines. It's similar to other situations we find ourselves in. Malcolm X used to say, if they can't beat you, they'll join you, and when they join you, you walk in a direction you never intended to go in the first place. And so part of the problem is, when we're in these institutions, they were not set up for us. They are not interested in what we want to do. But they have power. They are important. And we come from legacies of struggle in which people turn those things around, turn poison into medicine, turn humiliation into honor, made a way out of no way, found things to be done within those institutions that were never set up to be done. And I think that there's a way in which the three of us on this panel come from the tradition of the great organizer Ella Baker. And part of what Miss Baker always used to say is, be where your feet are. Know who you are to know who you want to be. And she tells a story that when I was 7 years old in Norfolk, Virginia, and a white boy called me the N-word, and I struck him back. And the audience always applauds after she does that. And Ella goes, no. I had to learn that fighting back one at a time would never work. I could never win a battle one-on-one. It takes organization, education, agitation, mobilization with a broader community to change things. So part of it is, of course, there is an anthropology of affirmative action. And anthropology is about the uses and effects of culture. Anthropology is criminally implicated in all of the hierarchies that we are talking about. And for that very reason, its tools can be very valuable. Luke and I come from cities in New Jersey where if we saw something that somebody had that was nice and it was working, we took it. And so I think you can look at what anthropology does and take it for your own purposes.
Thank you.
Okay. Three more questions. Oh, person in the red turban. Somebody here in this row. Oh, okay. Thank you. And do you want to stand? Sorry. And this person over here. Yeah, sorry. One, two, three.
Who's to say? Thanks.
Hi. I'm Caroline. I'm not an academic, but I've
seen... We can't hear you.
Sorry. I'm not an academic, but I have studied black history. And what I've noticed, I grew up in North London on a council estate, and I've worked in the private sector, the public sector, voluntary sector. I've worked within trade unions, and I've worked within the LGBTQ plus community.
Sorry, can you just hold the mic closer? I don't know if it's...
Sorry.
Is it working?
Sorry, yeah. Sorry about that. And I found the same phobia of black people in all of those areas. And basically, I've recognised that like people, as black people, we're powerful on our own, but we're so much more powerful when we come together. And the difference between Britain and America is we're in the belly of the beast. This is where everything originated. This is where the discrimination originated. This is where slavery was founded, the enslavement of black people. They have taken our history, they've whitewashed it, and they've attributed it to the Greeks who studied in Timbuktu in our universities. The funding from enslavement came here and funded their British Industrial Revolution. It created their middle class. It created their institutions. And so how, and Enoch Powell was a member of parliament who went to the Caribbean after the war, and got people from the Caribbean to work here as nurses, as bus drivers, the Windrush generation, as factory workers. And then when there were too many black people, when that fear kicked in, he then had this rivers of blood speech where he wanted to send everybody back. And from then onwards, and Notting Hill Carnival, a great event that happens every year, came about because of the murder of a black person. So basically, that person, Enoch Powell, went up to sit on the National Front and so on and so forth. So we need to have a different way of tackling institutional racism, because it's not the same. It's more surreptitious. It's more whitewashed than the American ones. At least with America, you can see it coming. But here, it's so hidden. It's so... But then it depends on which class you're dealing with. You've got the working class racism, then you've got the middle class racism, and then you've got the upper class racism. So how do we begin to tackle all of those within that history? And therefore, it's also a global thing as well.
Thank you.
I'm going to get two more.
Hi, I know you couldn't see me, so just to clarify, I've got a head wrap and not a turban.
Sorry.
That's
sorry.
Okay, no, I know you couldn't see me. I think, just first of all, making a point that policies going back in time, America comes to mind, where examples have been placed where it is said that the end of segregation has taken place based on policies that have ended and brought forth desegregation. However, do we as black people of color have to segregate ourselves in order for us to get ahead? Or have we never been fully integrated when it comes to our education, housing, everything that was shown in that particular video? About 23 years ago, I started dance training, and I auditioned and got into Laban. After a year, after speaking to a particular lecturer who is now passed just last year, I left after 1 year to go on to a degree, because I was on a dance diploma for performance. One of the reasons why I left was because I wanted to engage in African Caribbean dance. And at that time, over 23 years ago, that did not and still does not exist in the mainstream academic dance institutions. And so the reason why I shifted was simply because I felt that I'm not going to be a dancer. I'm going to be the person, train as a dancer, but the person then who introduces what it is that I don't have now down the line much later on. I have now started an academy for performing arts, which amalgamates Western and African performing arts, that looks at delivering what we call the intercultural arts education. At the moment, I have 30 strong students who all happen to be of African Caribbean descent and so on. So what I'm saying, asking at this moment in time, have we really been fully integrated when these policies over periods of time have ended segregation? Are we really where they say we are through their policies?
Put your hand up.
Hand up?
Yeah, sorry.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hi. I'm really enjoying the testimony, so mine's going to be quite dry because I just have quite a technical question. So I would like to invite you, if possible, to speak specifically about anti-blackness as a particular space of delegitimization and with colorblindness as a mechanism that serves towards that. And this comes out from when you spoke about the three pillars. I can't remember what terminology you used, but you spoke about the genocide of indigenous people, slavery, and apartheid as being all kind of fundamental pillars of the same thing and all apparatuses of delegitimization. But indigeneity, and I study indigenous knowledge, particularly with Maroons in Jamaica, suffer specifically from an anti-black rhetoric, particularly because the loss of place from slavery has denied the black diaspora of the opportunity of being producers of indigenous knowledge. So I'd like to ask you more about this idea of delegitimization. And this then leads to another thing that you were speaking about when you spoke about considering the dichotomy of being producers of knowledge versus the object of knowledge. So I'd like to invite you to also, can we then spread this out to the about being consumers of knowledge and what this political economy or cyclical economy of the production of knowledge looks like, in particular reference to delegitimization. And just finally, and I know, so this is all the same question, but just another little part. So this also appears that I was browsing, I wasn't kind of just surfing the web, I was browsing the Google book, kind of intro of your book, where you talk about, in one, I think it was page 8, you talk about this mend it, not bend it approach in this, in your new book. And I invite you to consider the idea that mend it is a legitimization of the natural evolution of progress. So, you know, it's, we're progressing past slavery, we're progressing past racism, this is all just a natural evolution. Whereas if we then take the approach of ending it, this actually is a delegitimization of this progress and an admission that something has gone horribly awry historically. So, and then this is final. Just because the first lady.
Then I'm cutting you off.
Okay, Abna. The first lady, she spoke about the plantocracy, which we all know in this room is the true engine of the Industrial Revolution and the Anthropocene. Interestingly enough, this week a paper in Nature has come out that they've decided to attribute the emergence of nuclear energy rather than the plantocracy as the defining moment of this epoch, the Anthropocene. And so maybe this is all entangled with the idea of delegitimization and what can countering Columbineness do to further this agenda.
Sorry, I'm done.
All right, which do you want to take? You said the ambition.
Do you want to take the what anti-black doing with it? Racism
and its
yeah.
connection?
Well, yeah. You know, I mean, blackness can deepen the stigma no matter who you are, no matter where you are, right? I mean, there's a reason why, for example, in the United States, the debate about affirmative action, the critique is cast in black terms, right? So, it, you know, people, if you talk to people in the States about affirmative action, what comes to mind, right, is a black person who's underqualified, unqualified. Now, you know, the major cases for affirmative action in the States, the earlier cases like the Funes case and like the Bakke case, black people weren't even the principal beneficiaries of affirmative action in those programs, but they were the focus because it's easiest to stereotype, right? Right. So there's something about the phenomena of slavery, the stigma attached to it, right? The stereotypes attached to it, right? You can say in contemporary America that most black Americans are lazy, and 50%, more than 50% of white Americans still believe that, right? So, you know, there's a power in the horrific stigma and experience of slavery that gets played out there. I wanted to say that part of our reaction to the mend it, don't end it thing is that that's always connected to a vision of a defense of affirmative action that we don't accept. We don't accept that there's anything problematic about removing obstacles that are unwarranted. The mend it, don't end it, the metaphors that people use for that, they analyze affirmative action to partial birth abortion. All right. They analogize it to something that's negative, right? And we see it as something that's profoundly positive and constructive in the context of what it means to dismantle the institutional implications of racial subordination. Okay.
Yeah, I think you may be looking at a different place, because mend it, don't end it was used in relation to affirmative action, and we opposed that stance on affirmative action. That was Bill Clinton's argument about it. But if you're talking about are we reformist or revolutionary, do we want to work within the system or change it, that becomes a more profound question. And the question of indigenous dispossession is important in this way as well. We want to remind people always that black people were the indigenous people of Africa, that indigeneity is not confined to the Amerindian peoples, and that colonialism pitted groups against each other constantly. And so blacks were given guns in South Carolina, even in slavery, so they could kill Indians. Indians were recruited to return runaway slaves. Blacks won distinction from the U.S. Army by being Buffalo soldiers and going west and fighting, helping to take indigenous land. But on the other hand, blacks had Cherokees owned slaves and expelled the black members of their group, you know, from tribal membership. And so, you know, these things that are wrought by history, and I think it relates to the question about when you mentioned Enoch Powell and Rivers of Blood, all of these are steeped not so much in legacies of bloodlines, but histories of bloodshed. And so what we share is an intolerable apocalypse from the past that keeps on happening. And I think that, you know, Billie Holiday's song, Strange Fruit, it's about a lynching, and she says there's blood on the leaves and blood at the root. Well, we encountered the blood at the leaves because colonialism, indigenous dispossession, were innately violent, brutal acts of conquest. And that violence morphs, but it's never been terminated. Can I talk to the issue of desegregation and to what kind of integration has gone on? We were never actually for simple integration or desegregation. It's not that it's so wonderful. Dr. King said, we're not for a romantic blending of colors. We're for a real sharing of rights, resources, and responsibilities. And the idea that you would simply have a few dark faces in high places, or you would remove some specifically racist obstacles, and then the society would be fine, misses the pathology of racism at the heart of the society. It's not just that it's racism. It's about hierarchy, exploitation, dehumanization, that racism is the crucible in which all of that is learned. And so, you know, under tactical circumstances, of course, we want to get rid of segregated institutions. But that doesn't mean that we have any fear or unhappiness with a room that's all black, a neighborhood that's all black. In other words, the black people have turned segregation into a form of congregation, which is a powerful source of intellectual, political, and moral knowledge that the entire planet needs. But on the other hand, there isn't one way to be black anyway. There's one more way to be anything else. And so part of what
again, think of Ms. Baker, you think of Dr. Du Bois, the tradition we come out of is saying that there is a first step of getting rid of expressly racist obstacles, but the real challenge is building new democratic institutions. This is what Dr. Du Bois called abolition democracy. We have to find ways to love ourselves and others when we've been made unlovable by this society. We have to find ways to reconcile ourselves with the neighbor who should be your brother or sister but is pitted against you in competition for small resources. And one of the inversions of this society is that the center has no moral or ethical way of organizing itself except plunder. The so-called forgotten peoples of history, the eyewitnesses to brutality and torture, are the ones who have a critique of that. And this is what we ground our work in.
I guess, one thing I want to call our attention to and just be thoughtful about it is how do we make the best of these opportunities to talk about racializations across different contexts? I think that is, that's what globalization of resistance might provide for us. So we know that the histories that have deposited us in these different places, adorned us with different kinds of burdens, is a history that is a wide global history. We know this from colonialism and from slavery and from plunder. And the question, I think, is these are languages of power that are spoken with different accents in different places. If we have these opportunities now to come together to talk, what should we be talking about? So part of the logic of this is, okay, I'm going to describe the part of the elephant that's most familiar to me. This is the stuff that we see. This is the way we've been trampled. These are the rationalizations for it. This is the justification for it. How does it work for you in your context? So it might be important to think about racisms. It might be important to think about all the different ways that hierarchies of peoples, of cultures, have been used to rationalize all of these historical dynamics of taking power, taking privilege, and benefiting from that, having those benefits being redistributed upwards. So what can we make if all of us are able to tell our story? So it may be that some of these stories we tell are really familiar. And it may be that, okay, it plays out a little differently in this context, but it's still a very similar game. So there are different technologies of racism, and they play out differently depending on what the stereotype of the group is. There are different racisms here, depending on if we're talking about Black people, Asian people. Just like in our context, there are different racisms, and there are different contexts. So, for example, we do some work in Brazil. In Brazil, the racism is often different because it's not so much a question of segregation, and it's not so much a question of trying to keep the bloodline separate. But there is a project of whitening that was very much a part of the making of the Brazilian state. When the understanding of what racism looks like only comes from another context, for example, if racism only looks like formalized segregation, like what happened in the United States or South Africa, some nations are able to say, well, we don't have a racial problem because we didn't do that thing over there. And it makes it that much harder for people to fight against it because, okay, it is different. And that difference sometimes makes it that much harder to develop the knowledge about how race played out in that place. So some of the work we were doing with some of our colleagues in South Africa was prompted by the debates about affirmative action. So affirmative action was something that came out of the World Conference on Racism. It was shocking, but it happened that in Brazil they claimed that they didn't have races, actually endorsed and embraced the idea of affirmative action. A lot of liberals, particularly in higher education, said, this is inappropriate here because we don't have races and we never had racial policies. So this might be okay to do in the United States, but it's not appropriate here. What's only when we started talking to find out, actually, there were a lot of racial policies in Brazil, the very immigration policies that were designed to basically eliminate blackness by miscegenation. Okay, so that was a pro-miscegenation policy of black erasure. If the only thing you're looking at is, are you for or against miscegenation, you might think, okay, so Brazil didn't have a racist policy because they weren't anti-miscegenation like the United States was. The United States was like, oh, we can't have miscegenation at all, even though the slave population was produced by miscegenation. That's a separate point. The point just being is, if you just look at the technologies from point to point, then that can sometimes distort how race is produced in one place as opposed to another. So we're able to see a little bit more clearly when we travel around the different technologies of racism, the different technologies of white supremacy. When we can create that language, when we can be multilingual about the language and the product of racism, it allows us to fight it collectively far better. So we're not here to say it's just like this here. We're just here to say, well, here's what we were dealing with. Here's how we worked with what we were dealing with. Here's how we went across the disciplines to identify what's your language of racism, what's your denial there, what kind of tools can you bring to the table to help us read it better, and once we read it better, what do you have for us that we can fight it better? If we think about the collective project in those terms, we can make better use of spaces like this.
I think we just have a few minutes left, so do you mind taking just a couple more questions? But I will have to ask that you just ask a question clearly, concisely, otherwise we won't have time to get through anything. We have someone in the corner in white there, and, pardon? Yeah, at the back, in the black, wearing the black top, who's just looking back, yeah.
Hi, my name is Megan. I'm actually a Canadian expat living here in London. And so I just wanted to ask if any of this work has been done in Canada. And if so, I'm curious to hear what that experience might have been like.
Hi, my name is Aladdin. I just wanted to ask, from your point of view, how you see British kind of cultural diversity policy and multiculturalism. And I have to disclose an interest. So for 4 years, between 2000 and 2004, I chaired the cultural strategy group at City Hall. So I was in charge of the Olympics, cultural diversity, tourism, the world cities. And obviously, and I also work in the restructuring the Arts Council and the British Council. So Britain has a very international and cosmopolitan and multicultural aspect to its culture and creative industries, and I'd be very interested to know what your take is on that, because it's a secret history of resistance, because I was appointed as the first person of color to head up in the European Union, to head up culture, media, and sport for a capital city, but it's an unwritten history. And sitting here, I was a fellow here in 1980, I was a professor in 1980 from American University, my dad was here in the late 40s, and I came here to do a revolution, but it's only sitting here now I can look back and go, oh my God, I was actually a fellow here in 1980, probably the first person of color in my generation in nuclear warfare or international banking, which I've left, but and hence in culture. But I just wanted your take on what you see as a success or lack of success of policy in the citywide and UK-wide, because the Conservatives here are also big backers of multiculturalism. So behind the scenes, Boris Johnson, for example, the big champion from the Conservatives here, is a big supporter of cultural diversity. So I just want to hear from you folks what your take is.
Okay,
strangely enough, no. Having spent time with a guy, it's a man.
Okay, let's put those two questions to the panel.
You know what?
And let them really just
take them all in our concluding remarks.
I think we've only got time for the two questions.
We're not going to do long answers, so just take them all.
How much time?
Tell them, like,
okay, let's take 30 seconds.
30 seconds.
Yes, and we'll make our concluding remarks, and we'll just sum up, but some of them we won't.
Okay, we're going to take two more questions along with those, and we have two people here who had their hands up before, so in the orange, and then with the short hair with your hand up, and then that will be it.
Short.
But please, very, very short and sweet. Yeah.
Hi. Hello. Okay. Hi, I'm a trainee therapist, and as a lot of people know, it's a very white middle-class profession. My question is about actually challenging smaller institutions. I'm training at the moment at the Minster Centre, and a lot of what I've heard back is just kind of lack of resources. But the fact is these resources could really help to actually diversify the therapy student and therapy students, because I know for me, money is a big barrier. So I just want to talk about challenging small institutions who say that there's a lack of resources, and making and holding people to account, saying, you know, you can't just say, oh, we want more black students. You also have to put your money where your mouth is. So if you're going to have a scholarship, make it specifically for people of color. They don't have that. And also, where is the data? Like, how do you hold these institutions to account, say, oh, we're getting more people, but where's the actual data?
Did you not? Oh, you didn't have a question.
I was
helping. Okay, well then behind you, someone with their hands up would take your question, and that would be it. Yep.
Hi, I'm Bella. My question is, how do you counter colorblindness in an environment where the language or the term just does not exist? So, like, where do you start? I was born and raised in Italy, and we are so far back in Italy that there's no language for even the word microaggression. That's not even a thing. You can't talk about race and sociology because the terminology, it just simply does not exist, and there's an active effort to keep black women from outside of black people in general from outside academia. So where do you start in a place like that? That's my question.
Is it Italy?
Italy.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to go?
Yeah. Now you go ahead, and we'll just make this up.
Okay. So in relation to Canada, the Enrich Project in Halifax is an alliance of Indigenous and Afro-Canadians who are working on environmental issues, especially around fracking, but also around urban renewal and traffic. Charles Smith in Toronto heads a Black Lives Matter a movement, which has done important work on police carding in Toronto. And we don't work with them, but we have great admiration, you know, for what they're doing. The issue of multiculturalism is always a vexing one, because sometimes they're interested in a multiculturalism about an axis of margin and center, but not about oppression and suppression. And so it becomes a way of talking about difference without discussing which difference makes a difference. And so we're worried about a powerblind multiculturalism. And then in relation to Italy, Loggia Garcia Pena, who is a black Dominican Italian, is written articles in the journal CalFu and has a book coming out called Black in English about Somalis and Dominicans in Italy and the particular racialization that they encounter and the ways in which they also are involved in the racial orders of Somalia and the Dominican Republic as well. And it's a vexing problem, as you know, but it's a wonderful work that I can recommend to you. And then we're going to make final closing statements, and my final closing statement is thank you so much for this kind of discussion. You know, we can see the seriousness of our time reflected in the energy and enthusiasm of your comments, and we never can provide solutions when we come to these meetings, but what we can say is with Dr. King, we have no choice but to return to the bitter but beautiful struggle for a new and better world.
Thank you, George, for providing those points in Canada, Italy. I guess I'll say something a little bit just more global. So I think part of the histories that we are trying to share is to identify the conditions of possibility, what we think made certain things possible, and that is a growing list, but it's a not complete list. So one of the conditions of our possibility was the fact that there was a critical mass of students
students who were matriculating at a particular time that had been socialized in institutional struggle, that had created an agenda based on their rightful expectations, and that were willing to step outside the expected in order to make demands that the institutions be responsive to. It was generational. It was contested, in part because even some of our elders who had fought for us to have access to these institutions had not themselves been in those institutions. So they had no idea what we were struggling with once we got there. So when we did do what we thought we were continuing, we more or less said, you guys sat at the lunch counters. We're sitting in the classrooms. We're sitting in the faculty library. We're doing the same thing that you did outside the institution, inside the institution. Many times their reaction to that was, well, that's not why we sent you there, right? That's not why we sacrificed. You're not supposed to go there and act up and act out. You're embarrassing us. And we're like, no, we're carrying the tradition into these spaces. So it meant we had to have a generational awareness of the difference between the institutions that they confronted and what we were confronting. We had to be confident that we were making legitimate demands. We had to develop our own language to be able to call out some of these things. So by the time we got there, there really wasn't a robust language around institutional discrimination that had traveled very far. It's not as though people hadn't theorized it, but up to that point, the most dominant idea for thinking about race was to think about it as prejudice. Is someone biased? Are they prejudiced? That was a very narrow way of thinking about racial exclusion. Yes, that's part of it, but much of racial exclusion happens unwittingly. It happens because I'm just going to do the thing the way we have always done it, and I don't care about the consequences. So we had to find a way of identifying racial outcomes that were problematic, that weren't necessarily attached to a raving lunatic racist in the mix. So each generation and each institution has its own demands upon us if we want to transform them. And it's important for us to go into that not thinking it's a project for one person or a project for one year or for one time. It's about collectivizing what we see, collectivizing our capacity to interrupt what we see, and then taking that work and passing it on to the next group that's coming in, right? Being able to transfer the knowledge from one group and one generation to another. So if anything that we've done has helped that, we're happy. If it simply locates the possibilities, we're happy. If you just thought that was crazy, we're happy with that too, because you stayed with us for 2 hours and we really appreciate your coming out and joining this conversation.
You know, I'm just going to talk for 60 seconds. You know, I think we need to move from the simple arithmetic of equality and equal protection to what I call the quantum physics. The simple arithmetic is assuming that people are similarly situated or dissimilarly situated. The quantum physics of equal protection is really attending to difference in all the ways that it matters across group experiences and within group experiences. You know, the multicultural, multiracial approach that we advance is also the approach that over centuries our enemies took. They had a very precise and brilliant multicultural, multiracial plan to subordinate us. They had public policies for Native Americans, public policies for Asian Americans, public policies for all people of color in the United States, right? And there was a commitment to do that and to make that work for centuries, for generations, right? We need the same kind of commitment to push back against it, to destabilize it. And I want to end with something that Kim always says that I like. She says, expecting social institutions to redress racial injuries without referring to race is like having to ask directions for a destination you can't name. And we have to move beyond that, and we can. And that's the work between a rock and a hard place that we have to do in whatever societal context we find ourselves in.
We'll talk about the conference.
Oh, and then we've got a critical race theory conference in New York. In April the...
April 2020.
April, yeah, so you're all welcome.
Well, I want to say a huge thank you to our speakers. I think this has been a really important call to challenge our knowledge base, to challenge what we consider to be neutral. We are operating in a colorblind society here. We don't have time to get into it, but we see in our equality laws here in the UK are expressly colorblind. And so this is a really important call to challenge and to think about, although as you said, it's difficult to come up with solutions, but to think about how we push back against the criticisms of colorblindness, if you will. So thank you very much to all of our speakers. If we can give them a huge round of applause. And also just to say a huge thank you to all of you for coming this evening, and thank you to everyone who has helped to organize and put this event together, the team that's come with our panelists and our LSE events team, especially Anastasia, who's at the back, who's put everything together. We can do a quick round of applause for Anastasia. And I think that's it.
Yes, thank you so much.
And follow Intersectionality Matters podcast. This is going to show up on that at some point. So follow us.
Thank you very much, and I hope you all have a safe journey home.
Thank you.
Oh, you're very welcome.